Hello, and thank you for joining me here. I suppose it's too early for me to have misgivings, but I fear you have been lured here under false pretenses. This is not a concert, and I am not a musician. Musicians are a breed, no, a species apart, towering above us like giant towering things, or, if you were awake during 10th grade English, like Ozymandias, the before picture. No, I'm a simple ethnomusicologist, and my ongoing study of Ottoman blind squirrel Dietz began in my attempt to get my ethnomusicological union card. You probably know that in the secret ceremony before we are certified, we vow to ferret out musicians who lived and died in poverty and obscurity, the poorer, more obscure, and the deader, the better, without, as we say, a wiki note to their nickname, and to extol the purity of their vision on an unsuspecting public. But I've already said too much, so back to my quest to prove that I was certifiable. I kept coming up with musicians' names for my project, and my committee of stewards kept rejecting them. Not obscure enough, not poor enough, not dead, but suffering from a persistent cough. After a brief discussion, we life-flighted that poor fellow a carton of cough drops. Smith Brothers. And as disappointed as I was that he was not yet a candidate for my thesis, I was impressed by my union's steadfast allegiance to the classics. That very Friday, he was once again on his stool in the back room of an East Memphis barber shop. Finally, in frustration and desperation, I cried out, "Blind Squirrel Dietz." While he is not actually poor, he is low class. His obscurity may well prove to be justified. He isn't dead either, although I have heard from those who say they are willing to help me out in that regard if it means that much to me. The steward's brows furrowed, and they glanced at one another. I took it as a sign of weakness and pressed my advantage. I did not give them time to reconsider before they signed off on my project. My bad. But enough about me. Ottoman Dietz was born Castor Dietz in Chesterfield County, Virginia, just south of Richmond, on January 1, 1948. The first time we hear about him, it comes in a letter his mother wrote to her mother shortly after his birth, in which she said that they had, quote, totally missed the boat on this one, close quote, which led a short while later to his three siblings, Zeman, Seymour, and the anonymous Albanian. But Castor did show signs both of the visionary spirit and of a determination to misuse that spirit early on, when, at the age of 8, he petitioned Virginia's Eastern District Court to allow him to change his first name from Castor to Ottoman. His parents objected, offering the dual rationales that Castor was a fine family name and that Castor himself was, quote, a boy and not even out of his short pants, close quote. Castor asserted that he would prefer that his name be associated with a swashbuckling former empire and a piece of furniture that is a visible sign of luxury and relaxation, rather than with some old Greek twin in a second-rate myth, whose part of the story didn't turn out too well anyway, and a medicinal oil that no one associates with anything fun or exotic at all, and besides, it tastes, quote, yucky, close quote, and used to come from the dried perennial glands of beavers. Virginia's Eastern District Court was a feisty bunch. This was the same court that several years later told Virginia's Governor J. Lindsey Ammond to, quote, suck it, close quote, NAACP versus Button 1963, when he tried to close the state's public schools rather than desegregating them. But it was a slow week, and the court, never having heard the part about the beavers, granted the request, with the majority opinion writing, quote, furniture and a fez? Sure, why not? Close quote. Dietz versus Dietz, 1956. Eminent legal scholars have confirmed that this ruling also includes the first recorded use of the word dickweed as a pejorative in reference to the dissenting justice and his opinion. Ottoman seems to have wasted his adolescence as far as the public record is concerned. But one must not forget, so did Jesus, if one applies a similar standard. In his early adult years, Dietz enters into what he calls his, quote, productive, parenthesis, unstoned, close parenthesis, period, close quote, and he puts a little frowny face over the word unstoned, which recurs intermittently into the post-postmodern or ultra era. But rather than present his works in the more academically proper chronological order, we will interpret them as he might, in a set, if he had the balls to show his face in public. In his self-absorbed but occasionally productive way, Dietz addressed a case of unrequited love by concluding that the object of his affections didn't really dislike him, as she had repeatedly assured him. No, she was in love all right. Her love was simply asleep. Hence the song's title, Sleeping Beauty. He reconstructs the fairy tale from the point of view of the prince, in the first person, of course, and introduces one of his repeating central conflicts, moral and ethical ambiguity, in this case, the chivalric code versus the code of love. The song has its points of interest. I mean, where else do you run into someone trying to rhyme something with catafalque, however poorly? And I have recorded the song myself in an unsuccessful attempt to recoup some of the losses I have incurred as the result of at least one of his antics. He seems to prefer an up-tempo version with a strange little bridge, which I will attempt to reproduce for you here. And you'll notice that he also seems to like letting his tunes trail off at the end, unresolved. Perhaps he's trying to draw attention to the lack of resolution in the conflict. Perhaps he simply can't figure out how to end the thing.
Standing here by this catafalque, seems like I'm always the one who's doing the talking. I'll stand another vigil and then I'll go home. I'll take off my armor and I'll be alone. Another white knight, another knight's duty, waiting for the waking of Sleeping Beauty. Never seen you move, but you move me. I've never seen you move, but you move me. Feels like years that you've been asleep and I've been standing here. But every time I look at you, I know that I'll keep coming back. You've got the perfect defense against any attack. Your sleep is just as strong as my chain steel. And inside there you can dream, and inside here I can feel. I've never seen you move, but you move me. I've never seen you move, but you move me. Now I could wait till it's just too late, without my books or bridges burning, or take that one little leap. I'll never know unless I take the chance, move a little closer, look for the answer. I'd almost rather die in any dragon's lair. I know you never ask for someone to care, and I never thought that I'd be forcing the issue. Maybe I'm gonna die, and maybe I'm going to care. kiss you. I've never seen you move, but you move me. I've never seen you move, but you move me. I've never seen you move, but you move.
This next tune, U-Boats Off Jamaica, is where the craft of ethnomusicology becomes an art. What sounds from its title like a simple reggae novelty tune is revealed on examination of its background to offer both depth and intrigue. To begin with, the rest of the Dietz brothers are on record as being, quote, reggae intolerant, close quote, so this is a direct assault on Ottoman's very siblings. But there are also notes I found to the side of the original lyrics that indicate that Zeman, who is a World War II aficionado and who is particularly fond of Nazi history, heard the tune and offered technical advice for it. And here's a bit of trivia for you that I picked up from these notes. The Type 2 U-boat had a crew of 25, the Type 7, 45, the Type 9 held 50, and the Type 21 had a crew of 57. The number 57 is circled, and you'll hear why in a couple of minutes. Again, note the moral ambivalence, Dietz's refusal to take a stand, which we will see is a central stylistic element. And just in case you're wondering why I have worried you with the number of crewmen in this strangely wide variety of U-boats, other than to reinforce the breadth and depth of the excesses to which the Third Reich was inclined, I mean, you'd think that five or six variations on the design of a long-distance underwater killing machine would be quite enough. Remember that if you, like King Arthur, find yourself at the bridge of death and the gatekeeper asks you, "How many in the crew of a German U-boat?" you can ask him right back, "Type 2 or Type 21?
Waves rush in from nowhere and over coral reefs and drown the sound of laughter after three aperitifs. The scene appears so peaceful, the scene appears serene, appearing through the crosshairs of a German submarine. U-boats off Jamaica, patrolling close to shore. Seasoned sailors do the work of a world at war. And then puts the war away. take a break from a world at war. Sailors confined for 60 days under tons of water pressure, everyone obeys. A tiny German U-boat, ripe fruit in the sun, dozens of stinking sailors on a lookout for some fun. U-boats of Jamaica patrolling close to shore. Dirty sailors take a break from a